Nobody cares for you like family. Family Heating
and Air. When you call to have your home or business's heating and air serviced, what do you expect from them? A salesman in a colorful truck? Or do you expect a highly trained expert with your best intentions in mind? The answer is obvious. Call the company that treats you like family. My name's Malia, and I look forward to answering your call.
Family Heating and Air Conditioning is your trusted local independent American Standard heating and air conditioning dealer.
Nobody cares for you like family. Family Heating and Air.
Only the best. Run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store. On 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan.
It is another year of talking about the greatest racetrack, the greatest sporting event in the world, the Indianapolis 500 and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway here on Beyond the Bricks from inside the Hensley Legal Group Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley. My name is Jake Query. Landon Coons is the man that puts everything together for us, and Mike Thompson joins me on the program. And Mike, a little known fun fact that people may not realize is the fact that in the off season, if you will, you and I don't speak at all. I'm kidding, of course. But of course, this is when we resume to talk about and go over the fabulous audio archives that you put together. And it always flies by in terms of the off season, if you will. But both of us are always excited, eager, and willing to talk about the Indianapolis 500. A pleasure once again, Mike, to do the show for another year.
Yes, and I'm very excited about being back. And I have to tell you one quick aside, which is you have the last couple of years have made some fun comments about how I have a 6,000 foot or 8,000 foot, and it always seems to grow square foot mansion.
Yes.
And I've actually never
owned it. Yes.
Yes, to save all the audio in. I've actually never owned a home until recently. I bought my first home a couple weeks ago and just moved in. And so I'm now talking to you from the palatial, you know, 2,000 foot square home that I just bought that houses the audio in beautiful Plain City, Ohio, which is my new residence. So this is very exciting. This is the first show from the new residence. And I live just down the street from Indianapolis 500 veteran Ed Pym. So we got to try to get him on the show.
Nice.
One night.
Well, here's the thing. I knew that you lived down the street from Ed Pym and that house is all 500 houses, because if I'm not mistaken, you actually bought your home at the memorabilia show, which was cool, right? So therefore,
I actually had to sell a lot of stuff at the memorabilia show to buy the house, actually.
Yeah, there you go. Well, Mike, listen, I know what this race and this venue, obviously, and the upcoming month of May mean to you. We're starting a little bit early. I know that so many people listen to this show also kind of throughout the course of the year, and maybe not just on whether we are airing on WIBC in Indianapolis or The Fan in Indianapolis, those that listen in podcast form. But I say it every year, Mike, but I want to repeat it again because I know you agree with me on this. The appreciation that we have for the people that do make it possible for us to do this and that listen to it every year and enjoy it. And in addition to that, I hope they understand that there are no two people more so than the two of us to understand that you and I just basically through luck are the ones that are able to do this. And we represent thousands of people that have the ability and the knowledge and the enthusiasm to do what we do. But we are absolutely grateful for the opportunity once again.
Oh, absolutely. And it's such a joy when people come up and talk to us, and you and I run into each other at the track, like at Mid-Ohio and things like that. And it's always so interesting where people say, you know, hey, we need to do the show all the year and we miss the show when it's not on. And it's just so gratifying that people, like you say, listen to it all year round. So, you know, I'm thrilled to be back and doing it again. And you know, I love the fact that people enjoy what we do. So it's exciting to be back.
But in the off season, when we get away from racing a little bit, we are, of course, always talking about longing for the Indianapolis 500 and talking about and discussing great events. And that's what this show is about. Taking a look back at the personalities, the behind the scenes stories, the audio history of the Indianapolis 500. But at the same time, when we get together each year. It is unfortunately part of the, well, just life in general. When you haven't spoken to folks in a year or so, you kind of recap things that have taken place. And oftentimes that means recalling or reflecting upon, or in this case, celebrating the lives of those that unfortunately we have lost, but fortunately we have the memories of from the last time that we were all together. That includes Phil Krueger, who passed away just a couple of months ago, as a matter of fact. Phil Krueger passing away on February 9th. And this is a gentleman that made a pair of starts in the Indianapolis 500-mile race. As a matter of fact, Phil Krueger, if you were to look at his career, just 1986 and 1988, two starts. And in those two starts, completed a total of 263 laps. But this is somebody, Mike, that their racing background goes beyond just two starts at the Indianapolis 500.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, Phil Krueger is one of those guys that you kind of want to call him the little engine that could, because he did everything. I mean, he was his own chief mechanic, basically. When he first showed up at Indianapolis at IMS, he had this just ancient eagle he was trying to put in the show, and he was running pretty good with it, and then had a pretty bad accident at IMS. And he later on had a really bad accident at Michigan at a race I was at the Michigan 500. But he always persevered, and you know, he put a couple of cars in the show at the Indianapolis 500, basically, with, you know, as his own chief mechanic. And he got a reputation. It's always interesting to hear what other competitors think of other people. And Phil Krueger was one of those guys who was always respected. You know, people really respected Phil Krueger and for what he could do, not only on the track, but as his own, basically his own chief mechanic.
He qualified 24th in 1986. Squirt, the soft drink, was the sponsor on the Moran Electric Machine. He would finish 31st after an engine would expire on lap 67 for Phil Krueger. He would return to the Indianapolis 500 in 1988, and in doing so that time, much stronger finish, because he was able to complete a much higher number of laps for Phil Krueger. As a matter of fact, he completed 197, I believe it was, in that 1988 race. But anyway, here is Donald Davidson talking about Phil Krueger.
He came to the track in 81 for the first time, and he had drove for Joe Hunt. He had an old Eagle with a Chevy, which he tried to brave in and crashed up in turn three on a qualifying attempt. 82, he basically struggled through several years, and the first time that he qualified was 1986, when he was teammate to Gary Bettenhausen on the leader car team, and had an old March, and basically he did all his own work and was able to qualify. And it's come so close. In 84, it's just like a typical Phil Krueger. In 84, he had his own car, or at least he was doing all of his own mechanical work. He didn't own the car. And there was a time there where there was a piece of body work that would include the cockpit area, and it was quite long, and I think he cleaned this or done something with it, and he put it outside the door. And early on a Sunday morning, I think it was like sort of, you know, 8:15 or something on a murky Sunday morning, a qualifying day, he laid this thing outside the garage door, and then they heard this really sickening sounding crunch, and a poor fellow that was driving the dump truck had gone into the restroom, left the motor running, and had left it in gear or something, or left it in, I don't know. Anyway, the truck rolled back and rolled over Krueger's body work. Anyway, finally in 86, he was able to make it, driving for leader cards with A.J. Watson involved in that team. But he was out. He was 31st. In 87, he didn't make it. And in 88 was the great story where he drove for Kent Baker and basically did all of his own mechanical work and he finished eighth. He could have finished sixth probably, because he did stall on one pit stop, but that was the car that came out on race day, and the side pods were covered, and when they took the covers off, they had painted Cutters on the side, which was the team which I think won the little 500 in the film Breaking Away. and since then there's been a Carter's team. In fact, I think they just won for the third year in a row down there at IU. Anyway, Kruger was injured in 1989 and he couldn't race anymore. He did build, he lives down in Brown County, he built a replica of a Sopwith Camel and actually was test flying it one day when he crashed the thing. And you may remember that it was on the news. It wasn't clearly apparent that I remember seeing the thing on the news and people called the next day and say, did you see that last night? That was Phil Kruger. And it never mentioned that's Phil Kruger that drove in the 500. And he had to name somebody else as the chief mechanic, but effectively he was his own chief mechanic.
Top 10 finish in 1988, eighth, as a matter of fact, where he would finish in 1988, talking about Phil Kruger. Now, of course, as always the case, Mike, unfortunately, Phil Kruger is not the only that we lost over the course of the year, as a matter of fact, of recency, because February 17th, another Indianapolis 500 veteran, Mike, would pass away.
Yeah, we lost Cliff Husel, the Canadian driver, just about a week after we lost Phil Kruger. And Cliff Husel is one of those guys who he actually was paralyzed in a road accident after his racing career. And so he spent the majority of his life, all of his life, basically after his racing career, almost in a wheelchair. But he was really good with fan mail. If you wrote him a fan letter, he would always respond. And he was really good with fans. But, he had a tough life after racing because of the injuries he sustained in this accident he had in Canada. So it was really sad when we learned we lost Cliff Husel. One of the things that's interesting about Cliff Husel, when he started at Indianapolis, he came to Indianapolis in 77, was in the 77 race, but then in 78 he had at the time a fairly little known hamburger chain on the car. Wendy's, believe it or not, was his sponsor. He had a very bright yellow and red, which were the colors of the time of Wendy's. He had a very bright, brightly painted Wendy's hamburgers sponsored car. So, it was cool that Cliff Husel brought Wendy's to the Indianapolis 500 in 1978.
In 1977, it was Team Canada was the name of the entry, and he would finish in the 22nd spot, five spots higher than where Cliff Husel would qualify. He finished 33rd in that Wendy's machine in 1978, and then Cliff Husel, not to be outdone, would come back and run one more time at Indianapolis. As a matter of fact, he would finish in the 29th position after starting 18th in the Husel Racing Machine in 1979, passing away on February the 17th. But in 2006, on the talk of Gasoline Alley, the historian emeritus, and at that time historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson, talked about Cliff Husel.
Cliff Husel, several years ago, was in an automobile accident in a truck, a pickup truck up in Canada, and he was quite severely injured, and I believe that he was in a wheelchair. He was at least partially paralyzed. I hadn't heard anything for a while, and that's been quite a few years ago. But I've been meaning to check up on that. I would say that's probably 10 years ago. Never heard anything about it at the time. It was Eldon Rasmussen told me about it because I hadn't seen him around for a while.
Yeah. How many races did he run in?
Three. 77, 78, and 79. And he was on the track in practice very briefly in 81, but that was just a test hop for Tom Klausler. But in 77, he drove what was apparently Johnny Rutherford's winning car from the year before, Team Canada Special. And then in 78, he got Wendy's for a sponsor after he had qualified, and that's the only time they were in it, and he was 33rd. I think he ran four laps, and then in 1979, he was 29th.
One of the things that I have mentioned before, Mike, but I think it bears repeating, and I will admit my own naivete as a child when I would go to the 500, and of course Cliff Husel was one of those that would be right there in the peak years of my early childhood and my first awareness of the Indianapolis 500 mile race. But I would go to the race and or before that listen to the race at my grandparents' house while my parents went to the Indianapolis 500, and would always kind of snicker, and my buddies and I, when we'd be racing our Schwinn bikes together and reenacting the Indy 500 like so many kids would do, whether it be big wheels or bikes, around the Indianapolis area, we would kind of poke fun at some of the names of those that were never necessarily the hard chargers that ran up front. And I was naive to the fact, Mike, and now I'm absolutely more aware of it than ever, as to the incredible racing accomplishment of even getting to Indianapolis, let alone being one of those that put a car in the show in that time period. It is the most remarkable of accomplishment of motorsport, aside from winning a major event or championship, just to have qualified for the Indianapolis 500-mile race at any point, but certainly in the era of the 60s and 70s, truly showed the merit and the marking of a champion driver.
Oh, completely agree. I mean, you have to consider, I mean, Cliff Usel came from a relatively small town in British Columbia, Prince George, British Columbia. I mean, it's about 70,000 people, roughly. And, you know, not only did he make the Indianapolis 500, he ran a couple of NASCAR races, too. You know, so he's one of the drivers who raced in the Indianapolis 500 and also made a couple NASCAR starts. And so, yeah, I mean, you look at these guys' record and you're like, yeah, they didn't run up front. They didn't have a top 10 finish, but they made the Indianapolis 500, and they can always say that. And going back to Phil Kruger, Kruger was one of those guys who loved coming back to the, you know, veteran driver autograph sessions and just signing autographs. And another guy like that was Bill Allsup. You know, Bill Allsup wasn't a guy who ran up front all the time, but he loved the fact that he was an Indianapolis 500 driver. I mean, Billy Englehart's like that too. So, you know, I agree with you. I mean, some of these names that we're talking about, you know, Ed Pym is another great example. Ed Pym drove in the 500. He also drove a couple NASCAR races as well. You know, those are the guys who, you know, really they made the sport. Maybe they weren't at the top of the ladder with the Rick Mearses and the Gordon Johncocks and those kind of guys, but you can't hold the Indianapolis 500 without guys like Cliff Usel and Ed Pym and those kind of guys.
Mike, we mentioned off the top the memorabilia show and just your, in particular, you know, your enjoyment of not just collecting, but also selling and helping facilitate for other collectors different amounts of memorabilia and things around auto racing in general. And that includes somebody that we lost also that I know was somebody that you enjoyed, and Dave Goss, who passed away since we were last together.
Yeah, I have to send a shout out to my good friend, Dave Goss. It's incredibly difficult loss for those of us in the memorabilia community and those of us who just, if you just love people. Dave Goss was one of my best friends. When we had the big snowstorm earlier this year, unfortunately, we lost Dave. He was just out shoveling his driveway and had a heart attack and he passed away from that. Extremely unexpected, obviously. And Dave was one of my best friends. He was one of those guys who would call to talk about memorabilia, and he was an absolute expert on memorabilia. Was always excited to say what he had found. You know, he was one of those guys that he would help people getting into the hobby. He was the vice president of the Indianapolis 500 Collectors Club before I was. I'm still one of the two co-vice presidents of the club, and he was vice president right before me. And he was just one of the best people in the world. And it's going to be a really difficult at the memorabilia show this year when I look over to his table and he's not at his table, you know? So just cherish those friends. He would always call. I tell people that I go to bed about 9:30 because of when my wife needs to get up in the morning for her job. And he would invariably call at 9:25 and he would call at 9:25 every time
smart.
And say, yeah, he'd call at 9:25 and he'd say, you know, we'd have this 45-minute conversation about the new things he bought and the memorabilia world and all these different things he found on eBay or something cool he found at a swap meet. And I miss those conversations. So, you know, cherish those conversations you can have with friends like that when you can have them. So miss you, Dave. Dave loved this show. He would call me after every show and say, hey, he would suggest some subjects and some ideas for the show. So definitely going to miss Dave this year.
You know, I am making a note of it because I'm known for calling people at 1:25 a.m. So, but certainly my condolences to you. I know on the passing of a friend and a proper tribute to Dave as well. There are those drivers that have also equally colorful personalities, zest, enthusiasm for the race during the time that they were here, and legendary stories about them as well. We'll talk about one of those when we return to the Hensley Legal Group Command Center here on Beyond the Bricks, episode number one.
If you've got Target Circle 360, you've got to start using Shipt same-day delivery. Shipt is bundled with Target Circle 360, so with one subscription, I can order delivery from not just Target and grocery stores, but PetSmart, Lowe's Home Improvement, Michaels, and more. Shipt isn't just another perk. They were awarded the number one delivery experience by an independent study in 2025. So, yeah, they're the real deal. Terms apply. Learn more at shipt.com/360. That's shipt.com/360.
The NBA playoffs are right around the corner, and now you can trade on every game on Kalshi. You can also trade on who wins each series, the conference finals, and the championship. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house and no odds maker. And as the odds move, you can buy in and out anytime throughout the postseason. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app. Use code HEART to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I, Kalshi. Trade on anything.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
And inside the Hensley Legal Group Command Center for Beyond the Bricks. It happens. Hire Hensley. Jake Query, Landon Kuhn's putting it all together for us. Mike Thompson here as well. As we talk about those personalities, the backstories, the audio that tells the story and paints the tapestry of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indianapolis 500. One of the most colorful characters to run at Indianapolis and one of the, quote, hard chargers, the term that I used to always hear from my dad when it would come to talking about a guy that developed a huge fan base between 1960 and 1974, the years that he would run at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Jim Herdebees, one of the more popular drivers of the era. And of course, there are stories about his dedication, his passion. At times, you would almost say his obsession of the Indianapolis 500 and his love for the Speedway. He was a sensation that began really in year number one, a year in which he would qualify 23rd for the Indianapolis 500-mile race, finish 18th, and make it within 15 laps of completion of the race. A part would break that would drop him out on lap 185. But here is the historian emeritus of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson, on Jim Herdebees.
He came to the Speedway from California because he'd gone out to run CRA, and he and Parnelli had become very good, very, very good friends. And they had Chevy-powered sprint cars when everybody else had an Offy. And but by golly, they were winning. And so they'd gone to IMCA together. And then Herdebees had joined USAC right before the Hoosier 100. So he won Sacramento. So when he came to the Speedway for the first time, he'd already won a championship race, except that 100 miles on dirt was very different from the Speedway. But anyway, so he drove for Ernie Ruse, the Travelon Trailer Special, and Ernie Ruse was a Mexican from Modesto, California, and he seemed to like rookies. If you look, many of his drivers were having their first start. So I think Herdebees was running fairly fast during practice, but I don't know that anybody was really paying a lot of attention. And in those days, when you look at 1960, there was no PA on practice days. There was no PA on practice days until 1967, believe it or not. And so unless you were on the crew or sitting up in the grandstands with stopwatches, you wouldn't know who was running fast or not. So and so the press would get their information from the timing and scoring people at the south end, who could clock like maybe two or three people at a time at the most, but you know, you couldn't time the whole field.
And so at some point, Hurtubise developed this rather unorthodox style, and whether deliberately or whether by accident, and then it showed up on the clock as, wait a minute, you know, that's, let me see if I can do that again. So he started dirt tracking. And so I think he was, and at that time, the track record, Sachs had won the pole, 146 something, and there was at least one lap at 147, which was the one lap track record. Well, Hurtubise was running 148 in practice. And I think some people thought, well, gee, my thumb's too quick with the stopwatch. And then, the final qualifying day, when he went out, I don't recall what point of the day this was, but anyway, he ran 149. The fastest lap was 149.601, I believe. And there was a bobble, so there was at least one lap that was a 148 with the bobble, but the four-lap average was 149.056. So he was above the pole speed by, you know, like close to 2 miles per hour. And it was an absolute sensation. And so he did it by dirt tracking, but he developed this this technique, which was effective because his lap time was less, and the record lap was like 1 minute and 00 point something. I don't know. It's just a blink of an eye. In fact, somebody had figured out that at the point where 1 minute elapsed, which would be 150 miles an hour on the dot, that he was 34 feet from the line. And at the speed he was doing, I mean, you couldn't you blink your eye that fast. So anyway, they went nuts. It was like the Walt Faulkner thing all over again, but 10 years later, this was a sensation. You know, who is this guy? He's a rookie. He ran 2 miles an hour faster than anybody. Who is he? And Parnelli Jones was with him. And Parnelli had actually been offered cars to drive, and he turned them down because he thought, no, I want to. Parnelli was very, very smart in so many ways. I don't know what his school education was, but sharp as a tack, businessman, and making the right career choices. And so he decided that he wanted to run the whole year on the circuit, as he put it, and then come back the next year. So anyway, when Hurtubise actually said over the PA, you know, if you think this is something, wait till next year when Parnelli Jones gets here. And sure enough, Parnelli's in some of the photos, and the postcard, the color postcard, if you look over on the fence, there's Parnelli in a blue sweater who would come and, you know, set everybody on the area the next year.
By 1963, now, of course, Jim Hurtubise had started on the front row in 1961. He finished 22nd in that race with a problem with the piston. But by 1963, Hurtubise had pretty good ride once again. He had a good ride with the Novi for Andy Granatelli. And Sid Collins, of course, was the original anchor, as everyone knows, of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway radio network in terms of when it became the network as we know today. And both Jim Hurtubise and Andy Granatelli sat down with Sid in 1963.
Andy, how much would you say has been put into the Novi development since you took it over from Lou Welch?
Up to the May. Well, April 25th, we had 238,000 on our books.
And these cars have a name, though, don't they? We call them Novi here at the Speedway through tradition.
Two of our cars are the Hotel Tropicana Specials. Our car number 6, driven by Bobby Unser, and our car number 56, driven by our all-time favorite here, Jim Hurtubise. And, of course, car number 75, driven by Art Malone, is the STP Special.
Let's talk with all-time favorite Jim Hurtubise over here, if we can. Herc, we recall when you came here and set the Speedway crowd back on their respective ears, almost going 150 miles an hour for the first time. That was in a conventional Offenhauser Roadster, wasn't it?
That was in the Travelon trailer. It was a Watson-type chassis, and it was before the straightaway was paved here, and it was, I think, it was the greatest thing I've done since I've been here.
How much more powerful, if it is more powerful, does the Novi car seem to you than the one in which you almost went 150?
Oh, I think these Novis are really exceptional. We were hitting close to 200 mile an hour down the straightaways when I qualified, and I know there is no Offenhauser here that'll go that fast.
Of course, the sound you hear in the background became so synonymous with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway of that era. So, too, discussion of the Novi, something that's always talked about when mentioning things of the 60s, Andy Granatelli, and et cetera. But what we have now, Mike, is not just one of the great voices of the Speedway, but this is an awesome clip because it's great voice number one impersonating great voice number two. Elaborate, if you could, and set up what we're about to hear.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite clips because we get Donald. Donald and I did an interview together one time where Donald will do a quick impersonation of Tom Carnegie calling the pass that Jim Herdebees makes on Parnelli Jones in the 1963 Indianapolis 500 at the beginning of the race. And then we get to hear the actual call. So this is actually one of my favorite clips.
At the end of the first lap, all the cars have gone by, and he says, Jim Herdebees, passing Parnelli Jones right on the starting line.
And here they come, and it's a battle between Jones and Herdebees for the lead. Jones and Herdebees fighting it out for the lead.
Jim Herdebees would come back and drive the Novi again to a lot less success. As a matter of fact, in 1965, Herdebees qualified 20th, but would come in 33rd as the first out of the race because of a transmission issue on lap number one. But in the 65 victory banquet, he had some humor about what took place.
Finishing in 33rd position from North Tonawanda, New York, the great Jim Herdebees. Herdebees received the Sportsmanship Award this year from the Writers and Broadcasters. Huge trophy. In 33rd position, Jim Herdebees. Speedway prize money, $8,261. Accessory prize, $365. Grand total, $8,626.
Oh, that's not too bad. Thank you, Sam. For the amount of sweat I worked up out there. You know, there's one good thing about coming in last, or being the first one off the racetrack. You're the first guy at the pay window, you know, and first guy in line. Can't say I really enjoyed it, though. I'd much rather have stayed out there and raced everybody. But some things happened. We had a little mechanical failure and got put out of the race in less than one lap. I didn't get my uniform very dirty. I didn't get very tired. I got sunburn on the top of my head though, standing out there watching the rest of the race. It was a lot of work getting back here this year, and I much more enjoyed finishing the race, running, but those things happen. There isn't many of them I have finished, really. I did make it, though. I got back here and got in the race, which was, I felt, was a pretty good accomplishment, and I was pretty proud of it. I didn't know for a long time whether I would or not, and I know my car owners didn't either. I want to thank them for having faith in me, and Dick Summers, Bob Voigt, and George Deves, and giving me a ride, and going along with my deal, and this and that. But we did make it. Things didn't turn out very good. Of course, that's their usual run of luck and my usual run of luck. We did finally end up with a car in the race, though, and I thank Andy Granatelli and his crew. They were a real fine bunch to work with. We had a lot of fun. And I'm glad Dick and George and Bob and Annie could get along and get together and make a deal on our sponsors. We had a lot of fun, and I'm glad to see we made a few bucks. Cover some of the beer money and this and that. Another thing, seems every year I get on here, every time I get up in the microphone, they turn the commercial on. I haven't quite figured that out yet. Maybe by being first this year, first up here, I might have missed the commercial. So, I got a little accessory money here and everything, and I want to thank those people. Didn't get very much, but next year we'll get a little more. So thanks, everybody, and we'll see you later.
The great thing about that is that's some audio that is new. You know, we're always coming up, or you are, I should say. I don't have anything to do with it, but you're always coming up with new audio each and every year from Beyond the Bricks. And to have it from Victory Banquet's very cool and something I think we'll probably hear more of.
Yeah, that's correct. I have to shout out the great Richie Murray from USAC, the public relations ace and historian. And Richie Murray, if you guys don't know, if you think I'm a good historian at any level, Richie Murray is about 50 times better historian than I could ever hope to be. I mean, the guy is absolutely amazing at what he does for USAC. He reached out to me at the end of the shows last year and said, "Hey, I have some audio I think you might be interested in for the show," because he enjoys the show so much, he told me. And together, he and I did a partnership, worked it out, and we digitized the audio. We're going to be hearing a lot more. And he's got some incredibly rare stuff from Victory Banquets, and we're going to be hearing a lot of it during Beyond the Bricks this season. So thanks to Richie Murray from USAC, and thanks for being a good supporter of the show, and thanks for all you do, Richie. So we really appreciate you.
I can tell people from the standpoint of, as I host a daily talk show in Indianapolis on The Fan Radio, for those of you that are not in the market, Richie's one of the best in terms of PR and just understanding and reaching out of, hey, you know, here's something we've got going on. Would you be interested in this? And then giving me the proper background information, all of the things from a public relations standpoint. Richie is absolutely one of the best, no question about it. One of the nicest, and also certainly the most thorough and professional in what it is that he does. Jim Herdeby certainly had a thorough career at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and a professional one as well, but it did deviate from that a little bit, especially in the later years, where he became at times almost kind of the sidebar storyline of some of the antics he was involved with, as he struggled at times to qualify for the greatest race in the world, the Indianapolis 500. Donald Davidson on some of Jim Herdeby's later efforts at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
He was really serious about it in the first few years, and he and his brother, Pete Herdebees, built the car. It was actually the cars, and they built them in a barn in North Tonawanda, New York, which was where Herc was from. And based on a car that he and his brother had built for the 1964 race, that is sort of like the forerunner of the Mallard, and that was the Tombstone Life Special, that Jim had one of his best runs. You know, you look at the records, and if you look at the top 12, the name Herdebees doesn't show up. But he had some really good runs going, and in 1964, it was probably to about two-thirds of the way through the race, and he was running third behind A.J. Foyt and Roger Ward. and then he dropped out. Well, that was a car that he and the brother built. That's the one that he got hurt in at Milwaukee, you know, just a matter of days later. And he and a few others still felt that although the rear engine cars were coming in left, right, and center, they still felt that a lightweight front engine car could still do the job. And I know Don Branson never liked the rear engine cars, and Judd Phillips supposedly and Watson were considering building a lightweight front engine car. They didn't. And but in the meantime, Hurtubise and the brother, they built what I always thought was two cars. And Don Shepard, the brother of A.J. Shepard, the driver, but Don Shepard, a longtime sprint car mechanic and chief mechanic at the Speedway, I asked him about that one time, and he said, well, actually, there were 2.5 Mallards, and the final one was never completed. And it seems to me that somebody purchased that not too long ago. But anyway, the one that we know and most people think is the same car, if you follow it through, it's actually two different cars. In 1967 was the first, there were two of them were entered, and Jim drove his own and qualified and got bumped, and the other one was sold to Eb Rose of Houston as the Racing Associate Special. And on the morning of the first qualifying day in hot laps at the Speedway, Eb Rose crashed, and the car was never repaired. It just sat there for what's going to be a little over three years. And then Hurtubise drove the other one. He got bumped in 67. In 68, as the Pepsi Cola Frito-Lay Special, he qualified, but I know that early in practice, I mean, he was seriously talking about qualifying for the front row. So it was a serious effort. And right. Then it ended up that it was a struggle to get in. He got in on the last day, in fact, which was actually Monday. The final, what should have been the final day, was rained out. They didn't have a full field yet, so they had Monday qualifying, and Herc made it on that. And then I think it was only 9 laps in, and he burned a piston. And that ended up being the last year that that a front engine car qualified. But he was back the next year and wasn't too far off for the next 3 years. 69, 70, and 71, he made incomplete attempts on all 3 years, but he was right there and kept changing the car. And then the aerodynamics, he went from a rounded nose cone to a wedge-shaped nose cone. And then, of course, by 72, now the wings were allowed, and there's a bit of sort of some misunderstandings here. He continued to enter the front engine car, but he was now driving for Dick Hammond and driving rear engine cars. So in 72 and 74, which ended up being Hurtubise's last start, those were rear engine cars. The 72 was a Coyote, and then I think a McLaren maybe in 74. I'm not sure about that, but anyway, he continued on with the front engine car, but he was less and less serious about it. I think that probably 71 was the last time that he was really seriously trying to qualify the thing.
We'll continue to take a look back and put a tie on all of it, looking back at Jim Hurtubise here on Beyond the Break.
Stay ahead in the fast-changing world of retail and commercial real estate with From Where I Sit, hosted by ICSC President and CEO Tom McGee. Each episode brings you conversations with top industry leaders, offering real-time insight into the trends reshaping our communities. From the future of the office market and AI's impact on real estate, to experiential retail, supply chain innovation, and emerging opportunities for growth, follow From Where I Sit, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home, with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SPINQUEST.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Good
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Inside the Hensley Legal Group Command Center, Beyond the Bricks here, Mike Thompson, Jake Query. It happens. Hire Hensley. Just kind of the evolution of his career and the interpretation of it. But the point being here that he had an up and a down in terms of the interpretation, but still a great career to look back on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little sad because he was an inspirational figure in the 60s after his accident in Milwaukee. And, you know, he had his hands, you know, shaped to fit a steering wheel. And I mean, such an inspirational figure and won a NASCAR race and all these things. And then in the 70s, you know, he pulled the stunt with the beer in the car and wasn't a serious effort. And then he got tackled on the front stretch by the police, you know, state police. Had to get involved. So, you know, it's really kind of sad. People think of him more in the later years, kind of this, you know, clown who wasn't really trying, and he was really a great driver. So unfortunately, it overshadows how great he really was.
But telling the whole story of Jim Herdebees, one of the things I hope we've done tonight, we'll continue to do that with other drivers as we continue over the course of the month. And thank you for listening to Beyond the Bricks.
Zaxby's Giant Chicken Finger Wraps are no snack. In fact, they're so big, they get their own menu. Get one in your choice of Asian Sensation, Buffalo Blue, and Chicken Bacon Ranch. And you know they're coming packed with three crispy, hand-breaded famous fingers, fresh ingredients, and their signature sauce all wrapped to perfection. Big on size, bolder on flavor. But that's just how they do it at Zaxby's. Zaxby's Giant Wraps, they're no snack. Who's got the sauce?